Part 2. In Northwest Austin, we stated that the Act imposes current burdens and must be justified by current needs. And we concluded that a departure from the fundamental principle of equal sovereignty requires a showing that a statute's disparate geographic coverage is sufficiently related to the problem that it targets. These basic principles guide our review of the question before us. Section A. The Constitution and laws of the United States are the supreme law of the land. State legislation may not contravene federal law. The federal government does not, however, have a general right to review and veto state enactments before they go into effect. A proposal to grant such authority to negative state laws was considered at the Constitutional Convention, but rejected in favor of allowing state laws to take effect, subject to later challenge under the Supremacy Clause. Outside the strictures of the Supremacy Clause, states retain broad autonomy in structuring their governments and pursuing legislative objectives. Indeed, the Constitution provides that all powers not specifically granted to the federal government are reserved to the states or citizens. This allocation of powers in our federal system preserves the integrity, dignity, and residual sovereignty of the states. But the federal balance is not just an end in itself. Rather, federalism secures to citizens the liberties that derive from the diffusion of sovereign power. More specifically, the framers of the Constitution intended the states to keep for themselves, as provided in the Tenth Amendment, the power to regulate elections. Of course, the federal government retains significant control over federal elections. For instance, the Constitution authorizes Congress to establish the time and manner for electing senators and representatives. But states have broad powers to determine the conditions under which the right of suffrage may be exercised, and each state has the power to prescribe the qualifications of its officers and the manner in which they shall be chosen. Drawing lines for congressional districts is likewise primarily the duty and responsibility of the state. Not only do states retain sovereignty under the Constitution, there is also a fundamental principle of equal sovereignty among the states. Over 100 years ago, this court explained that our nation was and is a union of states, equal in power, dignity, and authority. Indeed, the constitutional equality of the states is essential to the harmonious operation of the scheme upon which the Republic was organized. Coyle concerned the admission of new states, and Katzenbach rejected the notion that the principle operated as a bar on differential treatment outside that context. At the same time, as we made clear in Northwest Austin, the fundamental principle of equal sovereignty remains highly pertinent in assessing subsequent disparate treatment of states. The Voting Rights Act sharply departs from these basic principles. It suspends all changes to state election law, however innocuous, until they have been pre-cleared by federal authorities in Washington, D.C. States must beseech the federal government for permission to implement laws that they would otherwise have the right to enact and execute on their own, subject, of course, to any injunction in a Section 2 action. The Attorney General has 60 days to object to a preclearance request, longer if he requests more information. If a state seeks preclearance from a 3-judge court, the process can take years. And despite the tradition of equal sovereignty, the Act applies to only 9 states and several additional counties. While one state waits months or years and expends funds to implement a validly enacted law, its neighbor can typically put the same law into effect immediately through the normal legislative process. Even if a non-covered jurisdiction is sued, there are important differences between those proceedings and preclearance proceedings. The preclearance proceeding not only switches the burden of proof to the supplicant jurisdiction, but also applies substantive standards quite different from those governing the rest of the nation. All this explains why, when we first upheld the Act in 1966, we described it as stringent and potent. We recognize that it may have been an uncommon exercise of congressional power, but concluded that legislative measures not otherwise appropriate could be justified by exceptional conditions. We have since noted that the act authorizes federal intrusion into sensitive areas of state and local policymaking and represents an extraordinary departure from the traditional course of relations between states and the federal government. As we reiterated in Northwest Austin, the act constitutes extraordinary legislation otherwise unfamiliar to our federal system. Section B. In 1966, we found these departures from the basic features of our system of government justified. The blight of racial discrimination in voting had infected the electoral process in parts of our country for nearly a century. Several states had enacted a variety of requirements and tests specifically designed to prevent African Americans from voting. Case-by-case litigation had proved inadequate to prevent such racial discrimination in voting, in part because states merely switched to discriminatory devices not covered by the federal decrees, enacting difficult new tests, or simply defied and evaded court orders. Shortly before enactment of the Voting Rights Act, only 19.4% of African Americans of voting age were registered to vote in Alabama, only 31.8% in Louisiana, and only 6.4% in Mississippi. Those figures were roughly 50 percentage points or more below the figures for whites. In short, we concluded that under the compulsion of these unique circumstances, Congress responded in a permissibly decisive manner. We also noted then and have emphasized since that this extraordinary legislation was intended to be temporary, set to expire after 5 years. At the time, the coverage formula, the means of linking the exercise of the unprecedented authority with the problem that warranted it, made sense. We found that Congress chose to limit its attention to the geographic areas where immediate action seemed necessary. The areas where Congress found evidence of actual voting discrimination shared two characteristics: the use of tests and devices for voter registration, and a voting rate in the 1964 presidential election at least 12 points below the national average. We explained that tests and devices are relevant to voting discrimination because of their long history as a tool for perpetrating the evil. A low voting rate is pertinent for the obvious reason that widespread disenfranchisement must inevitably affect the number of actual voters. We therefore concluded that the coverage formula was rational in both practice and theory. It accurately reflected those jurisdictions uniquely characterized by voting discrimination on a pervasive scale, linking coverage to the devices used to effectuate discrimination and to the resulting disenfranchisement. The formula ensured that the stringent remedies were aimed at areas where voting discrimination had been most flagrant. Section C. Nearly 50 years later, things have changed dramatically. Shelby County contends that the preclearance requirement, even without regard to its disparate coverage, is now unconstitutional. Its arguments have a good deal of force. In the covered jurisdictions, voter turnout and registration rates now approach parity. Blatantly discriminatory evasions of federal decrees are rare, and minority candidates hold office at unprecedented levels. The tests and devices that blocked access to the ballot have been forbidden nationwide for over 40 years. Those conclusions are not ours alone. Congress said the same when it reauthorized the act in 2006, writing that significant progress has been made in eliminating first-generation barriers experienced by minority voters, including increased numbers of registered minority voters, minority voter turnout, and minority representation in Congress, state legislatures, and local elected offices. The House report elaborated that the number of African Americans who are registered and who turn out to cast ballots has increased significantly over the last 40 years, particularly since 1982, and noted that in some circumstances, minorities register to vote and cast ballots at levels that surpass those of white voters. That report also explained that there have been significant increases in the number of African Americans serving in elected offices. More specifically, there has been approximately a 1,000% increase since 1965 in the number of African American elected officials in the six states originally covered by the Voting Rights Act. The following chart, compiled from the House and Senate reports, compares voter registration numbers from 1965 to those from 2004 in the six originally covered states. These are the numbers that were before Congress when it reauthorized the Act in 2006. I pause here to note that reading this chart would not be particularly useful, but that it shows that Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Virginia had a gap between white and black that dropped from on the order of 49.9% in Alabama to 0.9% in 2004. And for example, in Louisiana in 1965, 48.9% gap to 4% gap in 2004. Other states similarly. The 2004 figures come from the Census Bureau. The Census Bureau data from the most recent election indicate that African American voter turnout exceeded white voter turnout in five of the six states originally covered by Section 5, with a gap in the sixth state of less than 0.5%. The preclearance statistics are also illuminating. In the first decade after enactment of Section 5, the Attorney General objected to 14.2% of proposed voting changes. In the last decade before reenactment, the Attorney General objected to a mere 0.16%. There is no doubt that these improvements are in large part because of the Voting Rights Act. The Act has proved immensely successful at redressing racial discrimination and integrating the voting process. During the Freedom Summer of 1964 in Philadelphia, Mississippi, three men were murdered while working in the area to register African American voters. On Bloody Sunday in 1965 in Selma, Alabama, police beat and used tear gas against hundreds marching in support of African American enfranchisement. Today, both of those towns are governed by African American mayors. Problems remain in these states and others, but there is no denying that due to the Voting Rights Act, our nation has made great strides. Yet the Act has not eased the restrictions in Section 5 or narrowed the scope of the coverage formula in Section 4B along the way. Those extraordinary and unprecedented features were reauthorized, as if nothing had changed. In fact, the Act's unusual remedies have grown even stronger. When Congress reauthorized the Act in 2006, it did so for another 25 years on top of the previous 40, a far cry from the initial five-year period. Congress also expanded the prohibitions in Section 5. We had previously interpreted Section 5 to prohibit only those redistricting plans that would have the purpose or effect of worsening the position of minority groups. In 2006, Congress amended Section 5 to prohibit laws that could have favored such groups but did not do so because of a discriminatory purpose, even though we had stated that such broadening of Section 5 coverage would exacerbate the substantial federalism costs that the preclearance procedure already exacts, perhaps to the extent of raising concerns about Section 5's constitutionality. In addition, Congress expanded Section 5 to prohibit any voting law that has the purpose of or will have the effect of diminishing the ability of any citizen of the United States on account of race, color, or language minority status, to elect their preferred candidates of choice. In light of those two amendments, the bar that covered jurisdictions must clear has been raised, even as the conditions justifying that requirement have dramatically improved. We have also previously highlighted the concern that the preclearance requirements in one state might be unconstitutional in another. Considerations of race that would doom a redistricting plan under the 14th Amendment or Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act seem to be what save it under Section 5. Nothing has happened since to alleviate this troubling concern about the current application of Section 5. Respondents do not deny that there have been improvements on the ground, but argue that much of this can be attributed to the deterrent effect of Section 5, which dissuades covered jurisdictions from engaging in discrimination that they would resume should Section 5 be struck down. Under this theory, however, Section 5 would be effectively immune from scrutiny. No matter how clean the record of covered jurisdictions, the argument could always be made that it was deterrence that accounted for the good behavior. The provisions of Section 5 apply only to those jurisdictions singled out by Section 4. We now consider whether that coverage formula is constitutional in light of current conditions.